Good morning. I am really very happy to be back with all of you at Grail House this summer. And especially glad to be back at Grail House this summer in cool weather. Soshin talked about how it's been in recent years, very hot, very humid, pretty trying conditions sometimes. And I think that for me, it was probably the main koan for summer retreat. By koan, I sort of mean challenge for practice. And I found that for me, complaining about the weather didn't seem to help very much. It helped to have a few more fans in the Zendo. And it helped to practice, mainly. So it feels like blessed relief this summer, but fresh koans have a way of cropping up. And I think that one of the koans, one of the challenges for practice this retreat has been sickness and healing. So as Fugan said, a number of residents have fallen sick. Fortunately, none gravely. Fortunately, we're just about back up to regular strength. How do we practice with this kind of koan? And again, I think that fretting about it doesn't seem to help that much. Having a nurse practitioner helps, and practicing helps. So Fugan said it, when he was sick and when he was healing, knowing that people were here continuing on with the practice really made a difference. So even though we've had cooler weather here, I've also been aware of the fact that out west, things have been very hot, and the wildfires are again raging. June was a very hot month, so conditions are very, very hot, very dry, and once again, there are wildfires everywhere. I looked up some of the statistics. A recent calculation for this year, out west, 35,000 wildfires so far, covering more than 4.5 million acres. Okay, so that's only the third worst year in the past decade in terms of fire and coverage. But in the 21st century, this incidence and intensity of wildfires has been on the constant rise. So I've been aware of this because I grew up in Northern California. We used to have wildfires back then, but it wasn't this kind of constant preoccupation. So that every year we're thinking about we're aware of it and concerned about it. It didn't used to be like that. A friend who lives in Carmel Valley, around where I grew up and where my father lived, said that temperatures have been in the 90s last month, this month. Some of you will remember that in 2008 there was a wildfire that nearly burned down the Zen monastery at Tassajara, San Francisco Zen Center's monastery. It's very close to Carmel Valley, actually, in the Ventana Wilderness, Los Padres National Forest. And Joan said that the last time we studied Genjo Kwan was when he was Shuso, and that was actually started in 2008. And it reminded me that I gave a talk in 2008 on Genjo Kwan about the wildfires. So something's changed. Some things don't seem to change that much. But I bring it up because I'm reading a book about this at the moment, about the 2008 fire at Tassajara and how the community there responded to it. And it's very engaging reading. It's called Fire Monks by Colleen Morton Bush. And it talks about how these two fires started up after lightning strikes. They merged and they began heading straight towards Tassajara. They had some time to prepare for the arrival of the fire, but they basically focused all of their practice on preparing to meet the fire. They sent away all the guests. They sent away a number of the residents, just cut it down to a special team. They were training people who didn't have prior experience in dealing with fires about what to do. A lot of hard work. They had, after a previous close call, they had installed a sprinkler system around the main compound called Dharma Rain. And so they were going around clearing all the brush, getting rid of all the flammable materials, wrapping the buildings in fire retardant materials. They were in contact with the fire officials. They had a whole communication system set up. The interesting question is how they were looking at this koan. Despite the lack of prior experience of most of the residents, and having only really a few weeks to get ready for it. So the situation is that Tassajara, there's only one road into Tassajara. And it was clear that the fire was eventually going to cut off the road. So at that point, there would be no longer any way to get in or out. So the question is, do they just evacuate the place completely and then abandon their beloved monastery founded by Shinryu Suzuki? Or should they try to fight the fire? And really, it's not hyperbole to say that it was a life and death question. There were lives on the line. The fire officials told all of them to get out, and they said that they were not going to put any professional firefighters at risk. And people were following this. Maybe you were following it. In Carmel Valley, in California, around the country, beyond the United States. But this was the wildfire koan at Tassajara in the summer of 2008. And so what kind of outlook do you take towards a situation like that? There were many different responses in the face of it. Concern, fear, hope, determination. The abbot Steve Stuckey, Ocean corrected my pronunciation. It's not Stuckey, it's Stuckey. We always have that joke. The abbot said, there's nowhere you can actually plant yourself if you recognize that things are completely flowing and changing and the next moment is unknown. Faith in Zen Buddhism is being willing to live face to face with the unknown and have confidence that however that goes is your true life. So the fire eventually crossed over the ridge and began to descend towards the monastery. And as it did so, it was picking up speed and intensity. And there was one professional fire engineer who was there overseeing things. And when he saw the way it was advancing on Tassajara, he made a split decision no longer to try to defend the monastery, which had been his approach all along. And he ordered everyone out. And people had different feelings about that. But they had decided that what this guy decided, they would all go with it. And so they immediately evacuated. They sent off a caravan up out of the valley. But once they got to the top of the ridge, five people, again, sort of spontaneously decided to go back down and to try to defend the monastery. So that included the abbot, the practice director there, and three other monks. And it's a pretty dramatic story, but the outcome was that after battling the smoke and the fire with the Dharma rain, after 6 hours, the fire burned through and burned around them, and they managed to save the monastery. There were some structures around the periphery that were burned up, but the core compound was saved. So it was a very fortunate outcome, due to a lot of commitment, due to a lot of strategic planning, a lot of hard work, but also to the adaptability to unforeseeable circumstances that came from an outlook of not knowing. Five years later, in 2013, there was another fire that threatened to burn down another Zen monastery in California. This is Yokoji, the Zen Mountain Center, which was founded by Meizumi Roshi in the mountains east of Los Angeles, where Roshi practiced for many summers. And some of you will remember that story. We don't have a full account of it the way we do for the Tassajara story, but I did save a newsletter from Yokoji about it. The fire started July 15th, 2013, the mountain fire, and it burned through Apple Canyon. There was, as with Tassajara, a great deal of concern around the country, beyond the country. People saying lots of prayers and dharanis. And ultimately, the monastery was saved. And it seemed kind of like a miracle. Most of the rest of the canyon was burned up. So why was the monastery saved? It seemed like a miracle, but actually, the story as I remember it is that the abbot there, Roshi Tenshin Fletcher, had seen this fire coming for many years, and he'd been preparing for it for many years. And what was especially key is that he had cleared an area that could serve as a staging ground for the firefighters to meet the fire. So the fire officials ordered everyone else out of Apple Canyon. But when they were taken to the monastery and they were shown the conditions there, they said, okay, we can do this. We can meet the fire here. And that's what they did. So it was prayers and dharanis, but also foresight and a lot of hard work. And then just a few days after that miracle, with the mountain slopes over the monastery basically denuded of all vegetation, the rain started. And then the mudslides started. And the mud and the water and the debris came pouring down into the monastery grounds. And they continued into September, major debris throughout the monastery, throughout the canyon. So that was the wildfire and mudslide koan at Yokoji. And the newsletter has some pictures of how it unfolded and a chronology. But what was the spirit with which they engaged with their wildfire and mudslide koan? We can get a sense for it in the newsletter. There's a Dharma talk by Tenshin Roshi, and it's on case 20 of the Book of Serenity, which is Jizo's not knowing is the most intimate. So I'll read you just a couple passages from his talk. About 20 years ago, Maizumi Roshi and I were standing next to a big cedar tree at the center. And he said to me, "I hope this old cedar tree will last for another 300 years. He wasn't just talking about the tree, but about the Sangha and this place to practice. Being young and confident, I said, "Don't worry about that kind of thing. There's not a lot I can do about 300 years, but I can show up in each moment. And I can do what needs to be done. And I can communicate and encourage other people to do it. This place isn't just about this generation. Sometimes someone asks me, "Why do you do these things?" We keep things simple. It's like everyday life in the sense that we get up in the morning, we sit, eat, work, relax a bit, go to bed. The schedule goes on and is always there as a resource for people to come in and be a part of that training. I don't know how it's all going to turn out for the center. There's no master plan. The important thing is to take the opportunity to support the practice that we do here. It can be brought alive by one person. It can be killed by one person. There's that opportunity there. 300 years. I'll do the best I can with the time I have. That phrase, "not knowing is most intimate," isn't about dumbing down, he says. It's not an excuse to do nothing. Actually, this is a source of creativity. How do we move through this? It's like a big open space there. How do we do it? Do we have the will as individuals, as a community? Do we have the backing of the community as a whole? Life and the opportunity to live fully is an important and precious thing. Whether I'm tired, whether I'm happy, whether I'm sad, life is life, and it's an amazing thing. Don't think I'm being Mr. Rogers here, always acting cheerful and happy. Just now, with the fires and mudslides, there's a hell of a lot of work to do. I'm adverse to it, but I'll do what I can because it's how I want to live. It's what I want to do as a human being. It's not for a reward or anything like that. It's how I live. I'm not encouraged by the prospect of an easy life. How somebody really goes through difficulties and acts to transform the situation, that's how they transform their own ingredients. That's far more important than any so-called reward. So, a question for you: what is your own wildfire or mudslide koan? Your own life and death koan? In her talk, Roshi told us what hers was. If we were to ask her what her practice is, she could say, "The United States of America." So how does one practice with that koan? I think Roshi gave us an important message, and her words were, just show up. So what's up for you? How do you show up for that koan? And she wasn't saying that to practice with that koan, we have to have everything figured out or have all the answers. It's okay not to know. Not knowing is not the same thing as know-nothing. Do you remember from American history the know-nothing party? I think it's worth remembering. In the 1840s, there was a white Protestant movement of the middle and working classes that was opposed to immigrants and religious others, in those days, Catholics. And they believed that those kinds of people weren't really going to be loyal to the United States. They shouldn't be given jobs. They shouldn't hold public authority. So that's not what we're talking about. Know nothing. And not knowing is also not the same thing as denial. I think there's a lot of denial going on in this country at the moment, for example, involving climate. So we're defunding environmental science. We're shutting down state environmental agencies. I think that is deliberately not engaging with the koan of the society and of humanity right now. And it's part of the reason why wildfires are raging increasingly throughout the West. Actually, I think not knowing about climate change could be the basis for some creative new thinking, socially, technologically, if we're really willing to engage with the problems. So not knowing in our own lives, it's sometimes it's that feeling where maybe you're just stuck and you're just not sure what to do, how to proceed. But sometimes that being stuck and that not knowing where to go can be like a gateway to find something unexpected. It may actually be a great thing for you. Those are the dilemmas that if we embrace them, can be the things that open us up the most and thereby lead us to deeper insight into change. And I don't think Roshi was saying that we have to be unfazed by it all, above it all. There's profound turbulence going on in our midst and in ourselves. And we can be a complete mess and still practice with our koan. We can still show up even when we don't have it together at all. And it may not feel good for you when you're doing that, but I have to say, when I see other people do that, who have that kind of self-recognition in the midst of difficulty, like, my life is a mess and I don't know what to do with it, it's actually very, very moving to see, rather than the kind of pretense that you've got it all under control. So what is your wildfire or mudslide koan? Maybe it's writing a Dharma talk, or maybe it's a snafu with your service position. Maybe it's your ailing body, or the ailing body of a friend or a loved one. Maybe it's a painful conflict with a partner. Maybe it's the future. Where will I be in a year? Where will we be as a community in a year? Where will this nation be in a year? I just want to say a word about our study text, Dogen's Genjo Koan. I confess I was up too late last night, kind of rolling around in the weeds, trying to get some sense about what this term Genjo Koan means. I was looking at different commentaries. What was it that Dogen was trying to say with Genjo Koan? Just the term itself, because there are very different titles that different translators give for this text. So we've got Kaz's text translation, actualizing the fundamental point, right? Nishijima calls it the realized law of the universe. Maizumi Roshi called it the koan of everyday life. And Roshi gave us a pithy translation, show up. I was also curious about the fact that some translators and some commentarists point out that the word koan in Genjo Koan is not the same word as koan in the teaching stories. that we're most used to when we hear about, when we hear the word koan. And I looked it into a little bit, and there is a slight discrepancy. In the word koan, one of the characters is a little different. It's not completely different, it's partially different. And we don't need to get into the details of it here. It's sort of obsessive stuff. But if you start to dig, you can see Dogen's language is actually very, very subtle here. Maybe not so surprising. We don't need to get into that either. But when we talk about koans, it's normally these teaching stories about the Chinese ancestors. Centuries ago, and it's true that that the term Genjo Koan is not referencing precisely those teaching stories. But just thinking about it a little bit, I think in the deeper terms of our teaching and our practice, I'm not completely convinced. Actually, I'm not convinced at all that ultimately there's a meaningful gap between koan, the way I've been talking about it in this talk, and Genjo Koan. The character ko in Genjo Koan and in the word koan is the same. It's the same character, and it means public. But public in the sense that it applies to one and all, applies to everybody, like an unquestionable state law or ruling from the emperor. And that ko can also mean equality, because it applies to one and all, regardless of one's station in life, regardless of the differences between people. So the deeper meaning of that ko is the universal law of reality, or the universal law of the Dharma, if we think of the Dharma as the law or the teaching of reality. So the universal law of reality, or of Dharma, as it applies to the different and specific forms in the world. And then Genjo also refers to the manifestation of different forms or phenomena of the universe. So I think if we look at causes translations, we could say that actualizing is Genjo, and the fundamental point would be koan. So ultimately, I would stick with Maizumi Roshi, who approached Genjo koan and the koan of your life as having a consistent meaning. And I think here Maizumi Roshi was consistent with Yasutani Roshi, who was his teacher. And I think this is what Dogen had in mind as well. In koan study, or in Genjo koan study, we're talking about the underlying law or principle or nature of reality, and about one's concrete specific experience, both of those things. The important thing that Maizumi Roshi always emphasized about koans and about Genjo koan is what they have to do with our own life. And I think that's always the way we have engaged in study at the Village Zendo. What does it have to do with our life? And I think that's what Dogen is talking about in that koan at the end of the Genjo koan. I'll just read it again. Mayu, Zen master Bao Che, was fanning himself. A monk approached and said, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there's no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself?" "Although you understand that the nature of the wind is permanent," Mayu replied, "you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." "What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere?" asked the monk again. Mayu just kept fanning himself, and the monk bowed deeply. So the matter is not abstract. It's very close by. And it's important for us to appreciate it in our lives and to be able to put that into action, the way Mayu put it into action on a hot day, maybe like those humid days at Grail House that we've had in recent years. I don't think I succeeded, but I tried to come up with a contemporary version of that final koan in the Genjo koan, thinking about our own koan of sickness and health here this week. So it goes like this. A bodhisattva nurse and a bodhisattva patient were doing a blood pressure test. A Zen student came up and said, "Bodhisattvas, the nature of healing is ever present, and there's no place it does not reach. Why then do you do this blood pressure test?" And they replied, "Although you understand that the nature of healing is ever present, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." "What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere?" asked the Zen student. The bodhisattvas continued their blood pressure test. So even if we know what our personal wildfire or mudslide koans are, it's not always clear to us how we can work with them. But I think that Mayu and the residents of Tassajara and the residents of Yokoji and Roshi have all given us examples and helpful pointers about how we can engage with those koans. You don't have to have it all figured out in your head. There is no master plan. And as Roshi said, show up. Don't turn away. Engage wholeheartedly with that koan, your koan, which is also the Genjo koan. Suzuki Roshi said, moment after moment, you should say, "Yes, I will." So the problem is not abstract. It can't be resolved in our head. It depends on constantly changing conditions, and it depends on our willingness to affirm our life as it is. So I started out talking about koan as sort of like our practice challenge, but really it's more than that, and I think Maizumi Roshi helps get at the deeper sense. He said, koan is the manifestation of ultimate reality. What is ultimate reality? It is your very life. How is your very life manifesting right now? Is it manifesting as the realization of koan? When you truly manifest koan, then your treasure house will open by itself, and you will use it as you wish. Use koan as the key to open the treasure house. Once you open it, what is inside is also koan, and the one who is turning the key is also koan. That treasure is also nothing but yourself, your life. When you realize this, then the koan is in manifestation. I have to say, actually, there's no such thing as koan or genjo koan. These are just words that we make up to try to help ourselves be awake in the midst of our lives. But if we understand that, then we can actually live freely our koan and our genjo koan, the ultimate reality of our life as it's unfolding moment after moment. So in the remaining days of this retreat, the remaining weeks of Ango, the remaining years of our life, if we're so fortunate as to have years, let's just try to be fully present to our lives as the expression of ultimate reality. In his last Dharma words before he died, Maizumi Roshi said, "Manifest Genjo Koan."